This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Iraqi security forces clashed with the Islamic State group north of Baghdad on Saturday, leaving at least 5 jihadists and 2 pro-government personnel dead. A joint force of army troops and state-sponsored tribal fighters raided an IS hideout in Tarmia, according to a statement from the military. The new raid comes nearly 1 month to the day after twin suicide bombers killed more than 30 people in a packed square in Baghdad. Of late, Iraqi security forces have ramped up their efforts to hunt IS sleeper cells. Abu Yasser al-Asawi, identified as the top IS figure in Iraq, was killed on January 28. Iraq declared IS territorially defeated in late 2017 after a 3-year fight aided by U.S.-led coalition airstrikes and military advisors, and IS attacks in urban areas have dramatically dropped since then. But Iraqi troops have continued to battle IS cells in the country's more remote areas. A wave of airstrikes by Syrian government ally Russia killed at least 21 Islamic State group jihadists in the Syrian desert over the past 24 hours. That's what the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights is reporting Saturday. The 21 were killed in at least 130 airstrikes in a vast area stretching from the central province of Homs to the border with Iraq, the British-based monitoring group said. The raids, which began Friday and continued into Saturday, followed a series of IS attacks on government and allied forces that killed at least 8 members of a pro-Damascus militia. In recent months, the vast desert known as the Badia has been the scene of increasingly frequent fighting between the jihadists and government forces backed by Russian air power. This is VOA News. The political future of jailed Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny is none of the Kremlin's business, President Vladimir Putin's spokesman said Saturday. Navalny earlier in the day lost his appeal against what he said was a politically motivated decision to jail him for nearly 3 years. A Moscow court did, however, shorten his original jail term by 6 weeks. And in other news from Russia, the country says its scientists have detected the first ever case of transmission of the H5N8 strain of avian flu to humans and have alerted the World Health Organization. In Australia, Facebook is back at the negotiating table, according to Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison speaking on Saturday. This after the tech giant this week blocked news sites on its site in the country. Facebook's abrupt decision to stop Australians from sharing news on the site and strip the pages of domestic and foreign news outlets also erased several state government and emergency department accounts, causing widespread anger. 2 people were killed in Myanmar's second city, Mandalay, on Saturday when police fired to disperse protesting opponents of a February 1st military coup. Emergency workers are saying it's been the bloodiest day in more than 2 weeks of demonstrations. Protesters took to the streets in several cities and towns with members of ethnic minorities, poets, and transport workers among those demanding an end to military rule and the release of elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi, as well as others. A Sudanese asylum seeker who fatally stabbed an employee at a migrant reception center in the French city of Pau had no terrorist motive, the Pau prosecutor said on Saturday. The prosecutor said that the assailant was not on a national list of terrorism suspects. Following Friday's attack, the man was detained by staff at the asylum center. The United States has decided to deport to Germany a 95-year-old former Nazi concentration camp guard who has been living in America for decades. And in other headlines, Algeria frees more than 30 pro-democracy activists, including a prominent journalist, in the first releases under presidential pardons issued ahead of the second anniversary of a popular uprising. And Britain's Prince Charles visited his father, Philip, on Saturday, where his 99-year-old father is being treated for non-COVID-related symptoms. For more on these and other stories, please visit our website at voanews.com. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Congressional Quarterly, Ashraf Khalil, Washington, D.C. Metro reporter for the Associated Press, and our moderator is Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome to the show. Here are the issues. President Biden makes big promises at his first town hall, billions in economic aid, millions of new jobs, and vaccines for all by the summer. The death toll in Texas is climbing as millions continue to suffer from the brutal cold without any heat or power. And the GOP at war with itself as former President Trump goes after top Republican lawmaker and former ally Mitch McConnell. Plus, the Biden administration promising to recalibrate ties with Saudi Arabia and considers its next steps in Afghanistan. Jonathan, Ashraf, good to talk to you both. Let's start with Biden's town hall this week with CNN. Biden on a stage in Wisconsin, getting questions from the crowd, a format that usually works for him. And he made a lot of promises there. A massive COVID relief bill to pass within a few weeks, creating 7 million jobs, and vaccines for anyone who wants it by July, plus schools reopening by his first 100 days. We'll get to the school issue in a moment because I want to go in depth there. But let's start with the other items on the list. Jonathan, given what we've been seeing so far, the vaccine rollout under this administration, how likely is it that that July deadline will actually happen?
Experts tend to think that he will make that deadline. And as a matter of fact, that he's setting sort of a low bar so that he can exceed it. So I think that given the production of vaccines right now, that it's very likely that he'll make it. You mentioned earlier the winter storms. That has complicated things right now because it is complicating the distribution of vaccines to many, many states because planes are grounded because of the storm, roads are bad. There might be some delay there, but I'm pretty confident that he's going to make it.
On the issue of vaccines, Biden did get some pushback for saying that there were no vaccines before he came into the office during this town hall. He himself did get a shot before he came into office, so obviously that isn't true. His supporters say he just misspoke since he has given the Trump administration credit in the past. But moving on from that, he did put a lot of self-imposed deadlines on himself at this town hall. People generally crave concrete goals, but does it also, Ashraf, put this administration in a box? I mean, not too long ago, Dr. Fauci said we'd have widely available vaccines by April. Now that's being pushed back to July. So deadlines can be tricky.
Definitely deadlines can be tricky, and seasoned public officials like President Biden, it's wired into their DNA not to put a hard deadline that you can then blow and have people point to you and say, hey, what about this? But as Jonathan said, I think he's working within some very comfortable margins here. He's very deliberately setting reasonably low expectations. As you said, his deadline is July. Dr. Fauci, as of a month ago, was saying, yeah, May seems realistic, maybe early June for everybody. So it is a realistic deadline that he's setting, which is why I think it's not much of a branch that he was climbing out on, which is why I think he was willing to do that publicly.
That's not a bad strategy. Keep the expectations really low, and then you can rise to those low expectations. He's had this sort of honeymoon phase with progressives. But during this town hall, Jonathan, Biden did push back on some of the important agenda items for progressives, like defunding the police and canceling school debt. So how do you see the relationship with that wing of the party going from here?
Well, I think progressives are going to be disappointed, particularly on the school debt. What Biden said was he would be willing to discuss perhaps forgiving $10,000 worth of student debt, but he felt that $50,000, which is what the progressives are demanding, is simply too much. And there's going to be tension. They will continue pressing for it. They haven't given up. And I believe that he will continue to refuse to give in to them.
Both sides sort of came together to beat Donald Trump. Now that that's happened, there are going to be these divisions that keep coming up. I want to talk about schools reopening. It was also brought up at the town hall. Ashraf, it's an issue that really is important to a lot of Americans, especially working mothers, some who have had to give up their own jobs because schools are closed. Can you help us understand what seems to be conflicting messages coming from Biden and his administration on this?
Well, I think a lot of the confusion on the messaging comes from the very complex and spread out nature of authority when it comes to schools in America. It's not really something that he can order. This comes down to regional, local school boards and comes down to charter schools. There's so much autonomy that many of these local systems have that really his opening schools within 100 days, that might be the most sort of dangerous or potential for failure, because that's really not something he can do much about other than lobbying from his very powerful lobbying position in the White House. But you can't really make these school districts do much from Washington. It's a deliberate system that's set up so that the autonomy is on the grassroots level. Here in Washington, D.C., where I live, some public schools are open depending on where they're at with the teachers union. The private schools, the charter schools are on a different schedule, and very few people can make them do anything.
It's such a good point. This administration, any administration, really doesn't have that kind of control over public schools. It's really a local issue. But Biden did run on that promise to reopen schools in the first 100 days. So he's got to own that issue because he ran on it. And as you mentioned, he does have this massive platform. A lot of criticism here is that the Biden administration is not really following the science. And the CDC just put out this new roadmap to reopen schools. But according to this roadmap, it'll make it really difficult for most schools in the country to reopen. And you have health experts, scientists coming out and saying it is possible to reopen schools relatively safely. If you do put mitigation measures in place, it's not 100%. But the flip side we're being told is that it's much worse for kids not to reopen. And as you mentioned, a lot of this has to do with teachers unions pushing back, Democratic-led teachers unions. So Jonathan, as Ashraf sort of pointed out, Biden cannot force schools to reopen, but he does have this massive platform to pressure schools and to pressure teachers union, would you say?
Yes, that's right. And there's a further complication here. There doesn't seem to be, or at least until now, a unified message coming out of the White House. So, for example, the White House spokeswoman, Jen Psaki, said in explaining President Biden's promise that after 100 days, a majority of the schools, and she made very clear that she meant 51%, in other words, the minimal majority, would be open for one day a week. And that seemed a bit of a cop-out to a lot of people. Biden then came back during the town hall and clarified and said that he wants to get it to be 5 days a week, but only kindergarten through eighth grade and not secondary schools above those grades. And getting to the issue with the unions want all teachers to be vaccinated before the schools open. Dr. Fauci has said that's not really necessary. So there's a conflict there, or at least a mixed message coming out of the White House on that issue.
And it's not only the White House folks there that seem to have differing ideas of what's possible. Even amongst Democrats, there's a division. For instance, in the city of San Francisco, a very blue city, the mayor there, a Democrat, is suing the school board in that city over reopening. Local officials say they want teachers to be safe. But again, as Jonathan pointed out, the science seems to follow that there is a relatively safe way to open schools, even without fully vaccinating teachers. And Ashraf, just one last question on this. Given that there's this split amongst Democrats, conflicting messages coming from the White House, and a lot of angry parents who want schools to reopen, is this a winning issue for Republicans when we're talking about the 2022 midterm elections? Or by that point, with schools likely to be reopened, will voters have forgotten?
I think 2022 is far enough off that this won't be an issue in those elections. For now, if you're a disgruntled Republican, it's just fun to watch the Democrats sort of like step on each other over this issue. So it's more just fun to watch than it is a relevant political issue that I think will affect an upcoming election.
Okay, let's pause here. When we get back, as you say, Democrats might be split on some issues, but Republicans aren't exactly getting along right now either. Look at what some are calling a Republican Cold War happening. Plus, the new administration looking to, quote, recalibrate its relationship with Saudi Arabia. We'll be right back.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Congressional Quarterly. Ashraf Khalil, Washington, D.C. Metro reporter for the Associated Press. And our moderator, Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome back to the show. This week, former President Trump put out a blistering statement, and I think it's fair to call it a blistering statement, attacking his former ally and arguably the most powerful Republican in Washington, Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell. McConnell, who voted to acquit Trump in the impeachment trial, was still very critical of the former president, laying the blame of the January insurrection on Trump. So, Jonathan, how did we get to this point where the two men are really going after each other?
You have to remember that Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell, in terms of personality and experience, are total opposites. Trump is impulsive. McConnell is very, very calculating. Trump deeply cares how others feel about him and what they say about him. Mitch McConnell could care less. Mitch McConnell is a political professional. He has been in this game for many, many, many years. Donald Trump, to be kind, is a political dilettante. McConnell was willing to pocket the gains that Trump made in terms of appointing conservative judges to federal courts. He didn't like Trump very much. It's kind of well known up on the Hill that he loathed him. But as I said, he was willing to take advantage of the conservative gains that he made. I think that what happened for McConnell is that Trump's behavior, particularly in the runoff election in Georgia, basically cost the Republicans the majority in the Senate. And that meant that it cost McConnell his Senate Majority Leader's position. So he lost personally because of Trump's behavior. So what's happening now is that the Republican Party is deeply split between those who support Trump and want him to be a influential figure in the Republican Party going forward. I think the latest poll was 75% of Republicans polled wanted Trump to play a major role. And then there is McConnell, who represents the old guard Republicans, conservative Republicans who believe in strong national defense and fiscal responsibility, strong national security credentials. And these two forces now within the party are at war with one another. And in terms of a outlook of what's going to happen, we'll just have to wait until the midterm elections in 2022 to see who prevails.
It's really fascinating. And Ashraf, to Jonathan's point, and polling amongst Republicans show that Trump still has this massive hold over his party. Lindsey Graham, a key ally of Trump, a senator, he's stuck with Trump through it all. He's basically been saying that Trump is the future of the party, and McConnell would be wise to remember that. So how does McConnell navigate the party away from Trump? Can he?
That is the question. I think it is clear that that is McConnell's publicly stated goal at this point, is to wean the Republican Party away from Trump and Trumpism and sort of keep the votes, keep the people that he brought into the tent, because Trump brought in record numbers. It's almost a chicken and egg thing as to who was using who for the past 4 years. Was Trump using McConnell? Was McConnell using Trump? And there's definitely a perspective where McConnell got as much as he could out of Trumpism. You know, he got the tax cuts, he got the judges, he stacked the Supreme Court. And once Trump was no longer politically useful to him, then he becomes just this giant liability. And that's where we're at right now. So, yeah, it's fascinating. McConnell has turned on Trump. So Trump publicly trashes McConnell's wife, Elaine Chao, who was Trump's transportation secretary for 4 years.
Yes, so let's not forget that. And also, I mean, as you mentioned, McConnell may have gotten a lot from Trump, but by making a deal with Trump, by getting close to Trump, he may also have destroyed the Republican Party as he knows and wants it. And Republicans are obviously pouncing on Biden's agenda, whether we're talking about the COVID relief plan or an immigration bill that's coming down the pipeline. But Does it make it much harder for them to attack the Democrats, Jonathan, when the leaders of their party are going after each other?
I don't think so. I don't think anything will stop Republicans from attacking Democrats. McConnell has said that the way to unite the two conflicting wings of the Republican Party right now is for them to come together to oppose Biden's stimulus bill. So I don't think there's going to be any hesitation on the part of Republicans to go after Democrats.
Well, Democrats, meanwhile, are calling for a 9/11 style commission to investigate the January riots. And Democrats have been arguing that there cannot be unity unless there's accountability. Ashraf, what do you make of the flip side to that argument that there was an impeachment trial, it's over, and continuing to rehash what happened will only keep the country mired in this sort of toxic and divisive moment?
That is going to be the exact Republican argument going forward, and it's going to be persuasive in some camps, like as sort of fatigue as Trump kind of, I don't know if he's going to really fade, but fades a little bit. He's not in the White House. He's not tweeting. So, yes, as Trump fades a bit, you know, the Republicans are going to be able to just kind of roll their eyes and say, why are we still doing this? Suddenly, the Republicans become the party of unity and wanting to move on and find a better future together. And why are we relitigating this? So that's going to resonate with Republican voters and honestly with some extremely fatigued Democratic voters.
And Biden has said he wants to move on from Trump as well. But there is a large portion of the Democratic Party that does not. And sort of look at this cynically, they can also rile up the base by focusing on Trump. But let's shelve that conversation, move on to Texas, where the death toll is climbing in that state as millions continue to face the brutal cold without heat, without water. You have carbon monoxide poisoning shooting up as people desperate to stay warm are running their cars in their garage. They're turning on their gas stoves. It's an awful situation. There's a lot of blame being thrown around. Jonathan, I'm a little confused here. Texas is the energy capital of this country. How is it that millions there have no power?
This is a structural issue for Texas. Texas is the only state in the union that is not connected to the national power grid. And they did this in order to avoid any federal regulation. When the weather is good, and usually it is pretty good in Texas, it's a southern state. Most places in Texas were getting ready for spring vacation and bathing suit weather when this storm hit. But one of the downsides of not having any federal regulations or freeing themselves from federal regulations is that they did not winterize their equipment. So, for example, they have wind turbines in Texas, quite a few of them, and 23% of their energy is produced by wind power. In other states that use wind turbines, they put in antifreeze, just like we do in our cars, to winterize your car. They didn't do that. So the turbines froze up. But also, because of the extraordinary nature of this storm, I mean, this is kind of a very, very unique storm for a state like Texas. Everything is frozen up. So on one hand, you can blame the lack of regulation and the lack of winterizing, but this storm has been so cold and so extensive that all methods of producing power, gas-powered turbines, nuclear power, all of that has frozen up. So the blame game doesn't really work because there are so many reasons why the power is gone. If you have to find one place to blame or one thing to blame, it would be the storm itself.
Right. There's a lot to unpack in that answer, and I wish we had more time to sort of get into this. But, you know, when California had rolling blackouts because of massive fires there, Republicans attacked California, a blue state. Now you have Democrats attacking Texas, a red state, for their power outages. It's a lot of sort of both sides attacking each other. Ashraf, how is it that extreme weather events have become so political? And I guess the broader issue that Jonathan brought up, as we continue to have these extreme weather situations, scientists say caused by climate change, is the issue here that the country in general needs to work on infrastructure?
One of the issues that, as we've discovered, everything can become political. If we manage to politicize wearing a mask during a pandemic, then everything becomes political. So we've already had the back and forth over, as Jonathan said, one of the problems was with the wind turbines. So you had one side saying, oh, see, this proves that green energy is leading us off of a cliff. Meanwhile, the truth is that it was just failure to maintain, you know, to perform basic maintenance of the green energy equipment that led us here. As we've seen, we as a culture have managed to politicize science in a way that cannot be good for planning or good policy. And this is affecting medicine. This is affecting climate change, energy. It's not a particularly good way to go. And places like Texas, I could totally see how they've ended up in this situation. You know, I was a young kid in Texas. I was 8 years old living in Texas. And it would snow exactly once a year, usually in February, and it would last one day. You had one day to, like, have your snowball fights, and then it would melt. They're not equipped culturally or infrastructure-wise for any kind of a serious deep freeze. So I can only imagine what's going on there with no power, people running their cars, people getting sort of like space heaters that are starting fires. They're just not ready for it.
Shayna, if I could just add one thing. The fact that science has been politicized and that we see this coming out in not only the debates over wearing masks, as Ashraf says, the science or the questions that are being brought up about the Green Deal in relation to the storm in Texas. I think what this shows is how deeply the country is divided and why that means that Trump, I don't think, is going to fade that quickly. I mean, I know that this is the hope of Biden, and by not even mentioning his name during the town hall that he held, he calls him the other guy or the previous guy, right? I know that there's a lot of hope that he will fade as a result of his being taken off Twitter and Facebook.
He's able to really tap into the divide in the country, and we're seeing that divide, as you say, play out in so many different ways, including this extreme weather event. So we only have a couple of minutes left in the show. I want to focus on some global stories. The White House this week said President Biden plans on, quote, recalibrating the relationship with Saudi Arabia. He's going to be reaching out to the country's King Salman instead of its de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. It's a definite shift from Trump's relationship with the kingdom that we saw. But what's the reality here, Ashraf? I mean, the crown prince is the future of the country. Can Biden just ignore him?
No. The reality is that this is partially cosmetic. Not to sound too cynical about geopolitics, but it's significant that he's publicly seems to be sidelining him, saying, oh, we're not going to, you know, that there's not going to be a call between Biden and the crown prince. That's a big deal. Like, symbolically, the way these countries take this kind of, like, you know, I lived in Egypt for a long time. And, you know, when the president would call President Mubarak, that was a big deal. The newspapers, you know, that's a status thing. So being frozen out publicly, that does affect status, and that does matter to these guys a lot. But this is where the oil is. This is our main strategic partner, America's main strategic partner against Iran. You know, there's just too much at stake here. So there might be some recalibration of the extent of American involvement in Yemen. This has already happened to an extent. But the core strategic partnership between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, with all of its flaws and all of its horrors, and the United States of America is not going to change.
And in all reality and in honesty, when the U.S. has to work with allies, sometimes those allies are not exactly perfect. Although Biden has said that the Saudis will not be getting a blank check from this administration when it comes to human rights abuses. So we're going to have to see how that plays out. Really quickly, last question to you, Jonathan. Another big story is the future of America's presence in Afghanistan. Trump promised to pull troops out. What are we hearing from the Biden administration on that front?
The troop pullout has been suspended, and they are reviewing the force posture in Afghanistan. It's not clear that the troops are going to be coming out. The military will review this and will hear what they have to say. But the peace talks that have been going on in Afghanistan in Qatar over Afghanistan are sort of frozen right now, and the Taliban basically say they are willing to keep on fighting. So this war, which has, I think, in September will have gone on for 20 years. So I think we're going to just see more fighting over there until there is some negotiated solution, which right now seems a bit far away.
All right. We'll have to watch to see what happens on that front. That's all for this week's show. Thanks to Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Congressional Quarterly, and Ashraf Khalil, Washington, D.C. Metro reporter for the Associated Press. This program is produced by Voice of America. I'm Shana Stulen. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, Anna Mateo and I bring you two stories about recent winter storms that have hit several parts of the United States. Later, Armin Kasabian answers a question on Ask a Teacher. We close our show with an American story. This week it is William Wilson, Part 1. But first, many places across the United States have faced extremely cold and dangerous winter weather in recent days. This includes states like Texas and Oklahoma, where such severe winter storms are uncommon. The lack of planning and preparation by leaders in those areas left locals without heat, water, gasoline, and other critical services for many days. At least 20 people have died this week. Experts warn that deadly weather will be hitting the U.S. more often, and that the country needs to get better at dealing with it. This week's storms fit a pattern of worsening extremes under climate change. They also demonstrate that local, state, and federal officials have failed to do enough to prepare communities for extreme and dangerous weather. "This is a different kind of storm," said Kendra Clements. She is one of several business people in Oklahoma City who opened their buildings to shelter homeless people. Some of them came in with frostbite, hypothermia, and ice in their hair. The storms served as a predictor of what social service providers and governments say will be increasing needs among the nation's poorest people as climate and natural disasters worsen. Other Americans are at risk as well. Power supplies of all kinds failed in the extreme cold, including natural gas-fired power plants that went offline in icy conditions. Some wind turbines froze and stopped working. The crisis has raised concern for power systems throughout the country. As climate change worsens, such severe conditions will become more common. Sarah Eftek-Harnejad is a professor of electrical engineering and computer science at Syracuse University in New York. She called the week's storms an anomaly, or unusual and unexpected. But such anomalies, she said, are likely to happen more often as a result of climate change. "There probably needs to be better planning, because we're starting to see more extreme weather events across the country," she said. "That could be in the form of severe cold like in Texas, or intense heat waves like the one California experienced last year that fueled deadly wildfires." Michael Craig is a professor of energy systems at the University of Michigan. He said the events in California and Texas show that what we have now is not going to do it in the face of climate change. It's only going to get worse from here. In Texas, wind power is a growing source of electricity. But most wind turbines operating there are not designed for very cold weather. Making small changes to wind turbines is one step needed to deal with climate change, said Roy McCann. He teaches electrical engineering at the University of Arkansas. Some Republican politicians, including Texas Governor Greg Abbott, have tried to blame wind and solar power for the massive outages this week. However, traditional power plants, which depend mostly on natural gas, provide the majority of power in Texas. They were the larger problem. Joshua Rhodes is a researcher on energy issues at the University of Texas. The entire system, he said, was overwhelmed.
A Texas town on the Gulf of Mexico has been experiencing a record-breaking winter storm. The people there are facing difficulties that come with such extreme weather, power outages, and shortages of food, water, and gas. But the people of South Padre Island are also facing another difficulty: cold, stunned sea turtles in the surrounding waters. Cold, stunned sea turtles float to the surface where they can forget to breathe and drown. They are also unable to avoid harm from boats or other dangers, such as hungry animal predators. For the past several days, wildlife experts and South Padre Island locals have rescued nearly 5,000 sea turtles from the icy cold conditions.
So this is the largest recorded cold stunning event in history. In 1980, an organization was created that tracks these kind of events, and it is the single largest cold stun event that they have ever tracked.
That is Wendy Knight. She is executive director of Sea Turtle Inc. The nonprofit organization is responsible for a large part of South Padre Island's coastline. The organization has been helping to treat the majority of the cold stunned sea turtles, with much help from the community. During the month of February, temperatures on the island are usually between 17 and 21 degrees Celsius. However, temperatures this past week were much colder, between 4 and 9 degrees Celsius. This unusually cold weather led to a massive sea turtle cold stun. Alan Foley is a marine biologist with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. He explains that cold stunned sea turtles are not actually injured yet.
But in cold stunning events, the turtles aren't injured. And even though their bodies are affected, it's only a temporary thing. Once they get into a little bit warmer water, they quickly rebound and are perfectly fine. It's a lot of work and it's a lot of turtles in some events, but the end product is you have a really high success rate.
To save cold stunned sea turtles, Foley says quick action is critical.
When turtles are rescued and protected from scavengers and predators, and they're put into temperatures that are okay for them, within a day or two or three, their chances of survival in places like Florida and Texas are really good.
Knight says she is in awe of how South Padre Island community members have come together to help the turtles while dealing with struggles of their own.
It is, it is awing. We've had hundreds, even thousands of volunteers participate in this process. Most of those people have not had power, electricity, heat. They have personal tragedy happening in their own lives. And they're spending 12 and 15 hours a day with us and our staff. That is awing when people put their own needs aside to help something that cannot help itself.
Many people in the community helped in the rescue effort, including leaders in business and government. Ed Com is executive director of the South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau. When Sea Turtle Inc. did not have power and needed more room for the rescued turtles, he opened the doors to the convention center. The large building itself did not have power during part of the storm. Knight describes the community-wide help as Herculean, or requiring great strength and effort.
Ed, the South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau, opened their doors and let us put 4,200 sea turtles on the floor of their convention center. It's Herculean, the efforts that people have put in.
Cold stuns, Foley says, happen often, but they are usually not as big as the one Texas is experiencing. Florida, he says, also had a large one back in 2010.
And actually in Florida, we pretty much have cold stun turtles every year, just not thousands.
While the events can be hard on the turtles and the volunteers who save them, cold stuns give scientists valuable information about the animals. Sea turtles can be secretive animals, Foley explains. But during a cold stun event, those secrets can be learned. Foley says that once a cold stunned sea turtle comes on land, it can be tagged and studied. Scientists can examine the movement of a sea turtle and also observe its changes in growth, disease, and injuries. For Wendy Knight, the recent cold stun has shown her something else. It has been a lesson in how effective a widespread community effort can be.
And the collaboration between Sea Turtle Inc. and the South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau and the city of South Padre Island is proof of that.
I'm Ana Mateo.
This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from Abrahan Ferrer, who is in Spain. Hello there. I'm writing to you because I'm quite confused with these three options here. Up to, until, and till. I don't know how to use it properly. Could you explain these words to us, please? Thank you very much for your support in teaching us English. Keep it up. Dear Abrahan, thank you for your message. Let's start with until and till. They can be used as prepositions to describe time. The structure in this case is preposition plus period of time. Here is a simple example sentence.
Until yesterday, John did not realize that until and Till had the same meaning.
And also,
till yesterday, John did not realize that until and till had the same meaning.
Until is used to show the time when a situation, activity, or period ends, as in,
I was up studying until 3 in the morning. I am so tired.
Until is also often used with deadlines, a time by which you must complete something. At work, your boss might give you a deadline. The boss may say,
you have until Friday to finish the report.
Till can be used in place of until in most sentences. Here is one such example.
I can't wait till next week. I will finally get to see all my friends at school again.
Up to is a bit more difficult to describe. It can act as a preposition or play a part in a phrasal verb or phrasal expression. But here are a few very general ideas. Up to can be used to show the place or level that is reached by something, as in,
the mud was up to our knees.
Up to can also mean as many or as much as a given number or amount. For example, imagine a person buys a very large car. The person might say,
my car holds up to 12 people.
Here is another example. Imagine you have just taken a major exam. You really want to know your results, but you have to wait. A worker at the testing center tells you,
you will have to wait up to 3 days for your test results.
The worker might also tell you this.
You will have to wait until Monday for your test results.
Notice that the worker uses until in this case because Monday is a time, not a number or amount. Of course, up to has many other meanings, but we can talk about those some other time. Well, Abrahan, we hope this helps to answer your question. And to our listeners everywhere, what question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Armin Kasabian.
William Wilson, Part 1.
Let me call myself, for the present, William Wilson. That is not my real name. That name has already been the cause of the horror, of the anger of my family. Have not the winds carried my name with my loss of honor to the ends of the earth? Am I not forever dead to the world, to its honors, to its flowers, to its golden hopes, and the cloud heavy and endless? Does it not hang forever between my hopes and my heaven? Men usually become bad by degrees, but I let all goodness fall from me in a single moment, as if I had dropped a coat. From small acts of darkness I passed in one great step into the blackest evil ever known. Listen, while I tell you of the cause that made this happen. Death is near, and its coming has softened my spirit. I desire, in passing through this dark valley, the understanding of other men. I wish them to believe that I have been in some ways in the power of forces beyond human control. I wish them to find for me in the story I'm about to tell some small fact that proves I could only have done what I did. I would have them agree that what happened to me never happened to other men. Is it not true that no one has ever suffered as I do? Have I not indeed been living in a dream? And am I not now dying from the horror and the unanswered question? The mystery of the wildest dream ever dreamed on earth. I am one of a family well known for their busy minds. As a small child, I showed clearly that I, too, had the family character. As I became older, it grew more powerful in me. For many reasons, it became a cause of talk among friends, and the hurt it did me was great. I wanted people always to do things my way. I acted like a fool. I let my desires control me. My father and mother, weak in body and mind, could do little to hold me back. When their efforts failed, of course, my will grew stronger. And from then on, my voice in the house was law. At an age when few children are allowed to be free, I was left to be guided by my own desires. I became the master of my own actions. I remember my first school. It was in a large house, about 300 years old, in a small town in England, among a great number of big trees. All of the houses there were very old. In truth, it was a dreamlike and spirit-quieting place, that old town. At this moment I seemed to feel the pleasant coolness under the shade of the trees. I remember the sweetness of the flowers. I hear again with delight, I cannot explain, the deep sound of the church bell each hour breaking the stillness of the day. It gives me pleasure to think about this school, as much pleasure perhaps as I am now able to experience. Deep in suffering as I am, suffering only too real, perhaps no one will object if for a short time I forget my troubles and tell a little about this period. Moreover, the period and place are important. It was then and there that I first saw hanging over me the terrible promise of things to come. Ah, let me remember. The house where we boys lived and went to school was, as I have said, old and wide. The grounds about it were large, and there was a high wall around the outside of the whole school. Beyond this wall we went three times in each week, on one day to take short walks in the neighboring fields, and two times on Sunday to go to church. This was the one church in the village, and the head teacher of our school was also the head of the church. With a spirit of deep wonder and of doubt, I used to watch him there. This man with slow step and quiet, thoughtful face, in clothes so different and shining clean. Could this be the same man who, with a hard face and clothes far from clean, stood ready to strike us if we did not follow the rules of the school? Oh, great and terrible question, beyond my small power to answer. I well remember our playground, which was behind the house. There were no trees, and the ground was as hard as stone. In front of the house there was a small garden, but we stepped into this garden only at very special times, such as when we first arrived at school, or when we left it for the last time, or perhaps when father or mother or a friend came to take us away for a few days. But the house! What a delightful old building it was! To me, truly a palace! There was really no end to it. I was not always able to say certainly which of its two floors I happened to be on. From each room to every other there were always three or four steps either up or down. Then the rooms branched into each other, and these branches were too many to count, and often turned and came back upon themselves. Our ideas about the whole great house were not very far different from the thoughts we had about time without end. During the 5 years I was there, I could never have told anyone how to find the little room where I and some 18 or 20 other boys slept. The schoolroom was the largest room in the house, and I couldn't help thinking it was the largest in the world. It was long and low, with pointed windows and heavy wood overhead. In a far corner was the office of our head teacher, Mr. Bransby. This office had a thick door, and we would rather have died than open it when he was not there. Inside the thick walls of this old school, I passed my years from 10 to 15. Yet I always found it interesting. A child's mind does not need the outside world. In the quiet school I found more bright pleasure than I found later as a young man in riches, or as an older man in wrongdoing. Yet I must have been different indeed from most boys. Few men remember much of their early life. My early days stand out as clear and plain as if they'd been cut in gold. In truth, the hotness of my character and my desire to lead and command soon separated me from the others. Slowly I gained control over all who were not greatly older than myself. Over all, except one. This exception was a boy who, though not of my family, had the same name as my own, William Wilson. This boy was the only one who ever dared to say he did not believe all I told him, and who would not follow my commands. This troubled me greatly. I tried to make the others think that I didn't care. The truth was that I felt afraid of him. I had to fight to appear equal with him, but he easily kept himself equal with me. Yet no one else felt, as I did, that this proved him the better of the two. Indeed, no one else saw the battle going on between us. All his attempts to stop me in what I wanted to do were made when no one else could see or hear us. He did not desire, as I did, to lead the other boys. He seemed only to want to hold me back. Sometimes with wonder, and always without pleasure, I saw that his manner seemed to show a kind of love for me. I did not feel thankful for this. I thought it meant only that he thought himself to be very fine indeed, better than me. Perhaps it was this love he showed for me, added to the fact that we had the same name, and also that we had entered the school on the same day, which made people say that we were brothers. Wilson did not belong to my family, even very distantly. But if we had been brothers, we would have been near to each other indeed, for I learned that we were both born on the 19th of January, 1809. This seemed a strange and wonderful thing.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.